This conference will.
In this call, we're going to talk about the abusive kingdom, otherwise known as abuse world. It may seem strange to spend a whole session doing that, given that you've lived in it, just as I have, but human beings are curious creatures, and we tend to be blind to what is under our noses. Many of you will have been brought up in the abusive kingdom, which is why it feels perfectly familiar to you. It's terribly easy to confuse what is familiar with what is normal, isn't it? Because what is familiar to us becomes our norm. Not that that means it's normal. What do I mean? Well, how about this? This is the kind of email I get several times a week. It said, "Dear Annie, I need to know if I'm in an emotionally abusive relationship. When my husband gets angry, he calls me horrible names. Then he apologizes and expects me to get over it. If I want to discuss it, he says it's in the past. He recently called me an effing cow, an effing asshole, and various other things. I didn't really do one thing to justify this. When he's angry, I get physically sick." She goes on to say, "He's okay most of the time, but I can't get the things he says to me out of my mind. If I bring it up, he has apologized. He expects me to completely forget it, and I'm having a hard time doing so. Is this emotional abuse?" More to the point, if it's not emotional abuse, what on earth is it? And should it really matter what label you put on it? Whether you call it emotional abuse, vile, incontinent temper tantrums, or simply intimidation. The fact is that he swears that he abuses his partner time after time and expects her to deal with it. Yes, he still apologizes, which to me indicates that the relationship is still fairly new, but he isn't taking responsibility for his outbursts, is he? And he apparently feels very little remorse about scaring her witless. When he's not incontinent with rage, he's apparently okay. Again, that is hardly surprising. He has his limits. Being in a constant hissy fit can be a little wearing. Besides, he has to think strategically. If he never ever stops raging at a relatively new partner, his explosions could lose some of their impact. His partner might still have enough clarity to walk away. Later on, when he's completed the brainwashing process, he probably won't bother too much with the apologies. But why does she put up with it? Doubtless because it's familiar. I grew up with a father who ranted and raved, especially on a Friday night. That was his regular slot, although he wasn't averse to doing other slots as well on other days. The interesting thing is that he didn't pick on me. His favorite target was my middle brother. But just from witnessing my father's regular Friday night rants, I learned several things. First, I learned that it was normal. My father and mother were quick to tell us what a normal family we were. We were an unbroken nuclear family, sure, but we are anything but normal. I believed them because they were my parents, so they had to be telling the truth. So I learned that it was perfectly normal for the most powerful family member to visit his fury on weaker members and say the most appalling things to them. Second, I learned the correct way to respond to this behavior by watching my mother. She sat there in silent compliance. So I learned that that was the correct way to behave. Third, I learned that men rage and abuse and women shut up and take it. I learned that my father was really doing it for our good because he was a good man, because my mother more or less said so. Both my parents honestly thought that my father was a good man and my mother was inferior to him. Fourth, I learnt how to cower and accept that my value was always going to be less than that of a man who spat bile and exploded with fury. How about those for some great learnings? Do you see how they set me up for the spending years cowering in a corner of the abusive kingdom that my husband recreated for me. Do you see how I found myself back in something that felt very familiar and therefore quite normal? I honestly found myself thinking on many occasions that my husband's harsh judgments were for my own good, that I needed that kind of sharp punishment or I would have turned into a complete bitch. Now, not everybody on the call will recognize their childhood experiences in mine, but I'm guessing there will be similarities. And there's a little exercise I'd like to do with you later on tonight that may well clarify exactly what you learned. Some of the things I'm guessing that you learned that made your adult abusive relationship familiar or normal would include learning that you're unimportant or less important than your brothers or other family members. Learning that in the family hierarchy, girls came way, way below boys. Learning that your feelings didn't matter. Learning that you didn't have a voice. Learning you had a duty always to be nice and put other people's feelings first. Boy, did we all have the right credentials to be ushered swiftly into the abusive kingdom by our abusive partner. But since this whole teleprogram is about learning to finally see what is under your nose and has been for a very long time, let's be as clear as we can about this. Since the laws of the land are enforced by the abusive ruler of the kingdom, abuse is a perfectly normal and acceptable state of affairs in the abusive kingdom. I'll say that again. Since the laws of the land are enforced by the abusive ruler of the kingdom, abuse is a perfectly normal and acceptable state of affairs in the abusive kingdom. Now, abuse is not normal or acceptable in the outside functional world. And yes, of course you'll meet dysfunctional, abusive people in the outside world, but that doesn't make their worldview normal or acceptable. It just means that a sizable proportion of people operate that way. And the more confident you become in refusing to be chained to your dark little corner of the abusive kingdom, the easier it becomes to give abusers the message that you can't stop them being abusive, but you won't tolerate that kind of behavior around you. Given that the eight persona approach worked well in helping you to really see the characteristics of the abusive man and the abused woman, let's stick with that eight-facet approach in describing the abusive kingdom. As in previous weeks, the chances are you'll find a degree of overlap between one facet of the abusive kingdom and another. And that's okay. All that really matters is to get you identifying the various features of the abusive kingdom as confidently as possible. Facet number one, the unhappy world of your childhood. I've said it before and I'll say it again. You're not stupid. You would never willingly have gone out of your way to recreate the scenario that made you unhappy in childhood any more than I did. Your focus was on getting away from what you didn't like and creating something quite different. But the chances are that, like me, you were so busy trying to move away from something that you didn't have a very clear idea of exactly what you wanted to move towards. And in a way, you were focusing on the thing you did not want far more than the thing you did want. Let me illustrate using my own example. Some of the things that attracted me to my husband were: he was more educated than my father, admittedly not terribly difficult. He was a professional, whereas my father was a businessman. He was more knowledgeable than my father. He talked about his feelings. My father never did. His political views were less extreme and objectionable than my parents. He was physically more demonstrative than my father. Not hard, given that my father never, ever hugged his children. He was nicer to me than my father was to my mother. I completely missed the point that there was no possible comparison. My father and mother had been together 30 years by then. The honeymoon period was well and truly over for them. Things I wanted from my future husband included having the strength to stand up to my father for me. How's that for abdicating your own responsibility? Taking care of the grown-up parts of living, which my father had always done in a lot of practical ways, making me feel like I mattered when I was with my family, which he did at the start because that was one of the key things that sealed the deal, and he was bright enough to know that. Do you see how much of what I did and didn't want focused on my family? Because I wasn't free of my father or my mother, I ended up marrying a variant of my father. Sure, it's not always our father that we marry. It can just as easily be our mother or another important, hurtful influence from our early years. The point is that because in our inner world we are still hurt, hungry, emotionally deprived children, we're almost doomed to look for another version of what we already know. And there are two things that are really sad about this. First, we haven't a clue that that's what we're doing. Second, because we're no longer children, we overestimate our wisdom. We think we'll be able to make this person love us and give us all the things that we lacked. We think we can love him into healing our wounds. Instead, what happens is that he inflicts more of the same kind of wounds on us, and we revert to helpless little girl mode. We're left feeling powerless to change the situation or walk away. We end up hooked back into the childhood struggle to make an unloving adult love us. Facet number two, Groundhog Day. In the abusive kingdom, no alleged wrong that you commit is ever forgotten. Before you've been together very long, you don't argue about one issue. You have major wars about every crime you ever committed. Nothing is ever resolved, forgiven, or forgotten. It is bound to come up again and again. In fact, as we will see in the final analysis, you have the same fight over and over again. The triggers may change, the abuse gets worse, but the things he will blame you for remain constant. Sure, he'll add new instances along the way so the list can get longer and longer. With my husband, it reached the stage where he would hurl all the crimes I had committed that he could think of at me with a good peppering of verbal abuse and then storm out of the room, usually in his shirt tails, slamming the door behind him. Quite commonly, shortly afterwards, he would open it again so he could stand there and reel off a number of other items from the list that he had previously forgotten. It would have been comical had it not been so unpleasant, especially when he's wearing only his shirt, underpants, and socks. It wasn't a pretty sight or a dignified one. And at some level, I was aware that the person I was facing was not an adult, but an enraged child. Every fight would peter out when my husband ran out of steam. But then, a few days or weeks down the line, there'd be another trigger, and he would start over. And inevitably, that trigger would remind him of further crimes that I'd committed. So he'd go through the list, slam doors, and tell me what a lousy wife and mother I was, etc., etc. You would think we might notice. You'd think I might have noticed instead of just worrying the door would come off its hinges. You would think that we'd be aware enough to register what's happening and think, here he goes again. But we don't. We don't because he triggers the old childhood hurt so effectively that we get totally caught up in trying to justify ourselves. Because we have the wound of not trusting our own perceptions and beliefs, we have to try and make him see things our way. And that's how we get caught up in perpetuating the Groundhog Day cycle. If we had the strength and the courage to say something like this, well, that's your perception and you're entitled to it. I've no doubt that it is a true and honest reflection of how you feel right now. And it has nothing to do with how I understand the situation. So out of respect for you and for me, I'm going to take myself out of this situation until you feel better, and we can sit and talk about it like mature adults. If you could say that, it would stop him in his tracks momentarily, in all probability. It still wouldn't make the relationship work, but for a moment, it would stop him. And then, in all likelihood, because he was confused, he'd become even angrier and possibly more dangerous. Your abuser needs the abusive kingdom. It makes him feel as powerful as he's ever going to feel, because he sets the rules and he knows exactly how to play this game. The only way to break the cycle of Groundhog Day is for you to do something different. But you must expect him not to thank you for it. Facet number 3, the playground, but on a very bad day. What happens when you have an issue to discuss with a mature, caring partner? Ideally, he confines himself to discussing the specific issue. He expresses himself in a controlled fashion. He addresses you respectfully. He understands that the relationship is valuable, and having a nuclear explosion will create unnecessary, lasting damage. He wants to find a way to negotiate a solution that leaves both of you feeling happy enough. And finally, he can move on and let it go. That's a bit different to what Groundhog Day looks like, is it not? And there's a very good reason for that. Think back to your playground days, and preferably the first few years of your schooling and being socialized, as the jargon goes. In those days, arguments came about when one child refused to do what another child wanted. One or both children would get very angry very quickly, and usually there'd be a lot of venting of that anger before they ran out of steam. Does that make you think of anyone, I wonder? The kind of things children say to each other with a view to hurting so that they can get their own way include, "I hate you. Everybody hates you. Everybody thinks you're horrible. Nobody wants to be your friend. I was going to invite you to my party, but I won't now. I was going to give you a present, but I won't. You stink." Or, "If you want to be my friend, you have to do..." Does that sound familiar? How often has your abusive partner thrown variants of those nasty little lines at you? Every time it's Groundhog Day, perhaps. But when you have an adult man standing in front of you, threatening you with his very physical presence, it's easy to lose sight of the fact that his small inner child is running the show. It doesn't make him any more lovable, and it certainly doesn't make him any less intimidating. Quite the reverse. The obvious lack of control is very alarming. You can't know for sure quite what he'll do next. But you do know that he's out to hurt you, so it's bound to be very unpleasant. There is no reasoning with an abuser, especially when he's in playground mode. And he always is in playground mode when he picks a fight with you. Facet number 4, the Bates Motel. Okay, the Bates Motel, as in Alfred Hitchcock's film Psycho, may be a slightly fanciful way to describe your experience of the abusive kingdom, but, on the other hand, I'm not sure it's too far from the truth. Old-fashioned suspense films spring to mind because of the sense of foreboding that fills them. Long before the horror starts, the music is preparing you for something nasty. And so it is in the abusive kingdom. He trained you so well that even when he's being charming, you can hear the warning notes in the background. You know that something horrible is lurking. You constantly live in a state of suspense because you know that he will vent his anger on you when you least expect it. In fact, when you least expect it is the very best time for him to vent his anger on you. Suppose you're actually enjoying something with him. If you feel happy, you'll start to relax. And if you start to relax, you'll feel inclined to be less of a shadow and more like the person you truly are. You might, perish the thought, be a little too assertive for his taste, so he really needs to do something to bring you back into line. Do you suppose that this has anything to do with why he spoils Christmas, holidays, birthdays, and all the events that really matter to you? Other similarities with the Bates Motel include how he can move with dazzling speed from one persona to another. In the film, Norman Bates moves from creepy Norman to his homicidal mother. In The Abusive Kingdom, your partner can move from charming or creepily charming to launching yet another ruthless attack on you in the blink of an eye. He can always switch from one persona to the other. And he doesn't have a problem with hurting you. He enjoys it. It's something that he needs to do to exert his control over his world and you. Abused women never understand why their partner mistreats them. They tell themselves that the real man is loving. He just has an anger issue or some kind of issue. By the time your abuser has got into the habit of routinely abusing you, you can't rely on his potential to win out. I'd invite you instead to think that you're exposing yourself consistently to the horrors of the Bates Motel for no useful purpose. Why would you do it? Facet number 5, bedlam. Bedlam, for US listeners who may not be familiar with the term, was the name of the world's first and oldest institution for the mentally ill. For much of its history, it was a byword for inhumanity and cruel treatment. In a word, it sounds more than a little like the Abusive Kingdom. Anyone who lives with an abusive partner finds themselves living in a crazy world in which the crazy person holds all the power. I've said it time and time again. Abusers are crazy makers. And the women I speak to just don't get it. They don't register how crazy their partner's behavior is and how that behavior is geared to make them feel crazy. When I was staying with my husband in that beautiful hotel in Venice, and he took umbrage and went off to sleep on the living room floor of our junior suite. That was madness. Putting himself through that discomfort in those circumstances to punish me was nothing less than an act of madness. But I felt so humiliated I didn't see that at the time. Jeopardizing your marriage for a few shoeboxes in the hall is insanity. Picking essentially the same fight over and over again is insanity. But there is a logic behind it. Your partner keeps you off balance by subjecting you to endless, unforeseeable attacks. Perhaps you've seen the Pink Panther films. Inspector Clouseau has a servant named Cato, played by Bert Krook. Part of Cato's job description is to launch sudden, unpredictable attacks on his employer. Clouseau is never safe within his own home. Cato will always come at him out of nowhere. An abusive partner has shades of Cato about him. You don't see his attacks coming. Anything can be a trigger. Unlike Inspector Clouseau, however, you never asked your abusive partner to attack you when you least expect it. Why would he want to destroy an intimate moment or a happy occasion like a family birthday or Christmas? Why would he attack you on the most nonsensical pretext, like wearing the wrong shoes to go to a restaurant? Being a crazy maker is a very effective way of controlling and undermining you. It makes you doubt your own sanity. And of course, he will tell you that you're mad over and over again. If you don't accept his version of situations, he'll tell you that you're mad. But if you were to accept his skewed account of situations, you would go mad. The constant psychological pressure leads you to doubt yourself, which increases his power over you. No wonder abused women feel they are losing their grip on reality. They are. They try their best to hold on to their truth by their fingernails, and their partner constantly tries to prise that truth away from them. I don't have to tell you that it is very unsettling to live in close proximity to someone who is behaving quite crazily. When you feel like you're going mad in a relationship, it's because you are being driven mad. An abusive partner shifts blame for the craziness as he shifts blame for everything else onto you. It works for him. Facet number 6, 1984. George Orwell's novel depicts a world of perpetual war, pervasive government surveillance, and incessant mind control. Now, doesn't that sound a little like your abusive relationship? That's not the way you ever thought about it, most likely. You like to think of the outbreaks of hostilities as a series of blips. But they're more than that. They are one of the core characteristics of your abusive relationship. In Orwell's novel, the war is a device used to keep the citizens under strict control. Does that sound at all familiar? The citizens know that they are never free to express themselves openly and honestly. They are always being watched. They're never safe. They have to be guarded, watchful, and defensive. The specter of Big Brother, not the television program, looms large over the individual. I know a woman whose husband calls her at home every day, precisely 5 minutes after he expects her back from college. She doesn't feel free even to go to the bathroom until she has answered his call. Other abusers exert the same kind of psychological pressure in different ways. And then there is the mind control. What can I say? What is calling you too sensitive if it isn't mind control? What about when he tells you that you have exaggerated, distorted, or misinterpreted something that happened between the two of you? When he rejects your point of view and dismisses your feelings out of hand? Is that not mind control? When he tells you who you can and cannot associate with, how you should view different people in your life, and how you should think? That's pure 1984. Has he ever said to you, in a non-confrontational way, you know, you and I see the situation from two very different points of view. Mine feels right to me, and I understand that yours is right for you. While I don't agree with your point of view in this case, I respect and value you, and I acknowledge your right to think that way. Has he ever said anything like that to you? Or did he tell you that you're a fool or crazy for having a point of view that differed from his? And then, of course, he punished you for it. Once again, shades of 1984. You've been living under a totalitarian regime with a dictator for a partner. Why would you do that? Why would you surrender your right to your own life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Facet number 7, shifting sands. If you're anything like I was, then you'd probably say that consistency is one thing you crave from your abusive partner, and it's never on offer. In fact, there's a great deal of consistency in the abusive kingdom. The only problem is that you're not aware of it, because the consistency you get doesn't look anything like the consistency you were hoping for. The sad truth is that you and I have been misled, or more consistently, have misled ourselves. Because we wanted a loving relationship with a supportive, caring partner, that's the kind of consistency that we focused on. And that is precisely the kind of consistency that an abusive partner is not prepared to offer. Think back honestly for a moment. Separate as much as you can your aspirations from any promises he made, any undertakings he made to you. Did he promise to love you for the rest of your life? Did he tell you that he would do his best at all times to be a loving and supportive partner? Did he talk about the relationship he wanted, and this is the important part, what he was prepared to do to bring that relationship about? More importantly, did he act in a way that gave you reason to believe that he wanted to be a loving, supportive partner to you in a relationship that he saw as capable of continuous improvement? When you look back, the chances are that you'll see that kind of relationship was not the kind of relationship he was offering. But you didn't feel comfortable calling on him on what he was offering, did you? I'm guessing that one thing he never, ever offered or even hinted at was the kind of positive, supportive, loving consistency that you yearned for. Of course you never called him on that. You probably didn't altogether believe that loving, supportive consistency existed for you. Even supposing that in your wildest, most utopian imaginings you believed it did exist, did you truly believe you deserved someone who thought the very best of you? Did you honestly believe you deserved someone who is prepared to support you unconditionally, as well as lovingly hold and encourage you to be the best that you could? I'm guessing you did not. That may have been what you'd have liked to believe, but it's not what you were programmed to believe. Still, because you were looking for a certain kind of consistency that was sorely lacking, you completely ignored the dark, harsh behaviors he consistently revealed. As we mentioned in week one, your abusive partner worked consistently to make himself feel good at your expense, hurt and humiliate you, spoil your pleasure, and isolate you from loved ones. One of the great techniques he used to achieve his sorry goals was the shifting sands technique. The simple technique is one that he used time and time again. And you know what? It worked every time. You fell for it every time, just like I did. What do I mean you fell for it? You got sucked in and hurt by the individual scenario instead of stepping back and taking stock of the pattern he used. One very common pattern goes like this. Stage one, you spend ages persuading your partner to agree to something that really matters to you. Stage two, he finally agrees. You become really excited and delighted because you have his agreement. It must mean he's taking your wishes on board, mustn't it? Stage three, either before the thing that you're looking forward to so much comes about, or else when you're thinking that you'll be able to enjoy it together like a normal couple, it's taken away from you by stage four. This is when he tells you that he never wanted it in the first place. You nagged him into it. He always feels he has to give in to your unreasonable demands. You never take his feelings into account. Interesting. So we've just got a little technological hitch here. If he plays his cards right, you end up fixating on what you feel has been taken away from you. In fact, you end up so frustrated and upset that you miss the underlying pattern. This is something that he does again and again. The consistency is there, all right. Promising and then breaking promise is a fantastic way to break your spirit. The better it's done, the less likely you are to express your wants and needs in the future. The shifting sands technique will always start either from a hard-won agreement or some perceived common ground, which he then snatches away from under your feet. In later years, my husband used the shifting sands technique to maximize the damage he caused with my friends and even his own daughter. In that case, the strategy worked like this. Step one, wait for a harmonious situation where everything seems to be going really well. Step two, throw in the verbal hand grenade. Step three, acknowledge to your partner that you're out of order and agree to apologize to the people you have offended. Step four, repeat your offensive words to them. The promised apology followed by the twist of the knife is exceptionally destructive. The shifting sands technique means that you can never ever take anything for granted with your partner. His word means nothing. Past precedents count for nothing. Feelings, yours and other people's, count for nothing. My husband was not averse to using the shifting sands technique on his own daughter. The final beauty of the shifting sands technique is that it makes you susceptible to facet number 8, Stockholm syndrome. Stockholm syndrome describes a psychological phenomenon whereby hostages express adulation and positive feelings towards their captors. These positive feelings appear irrational to outsiders, but the victims mistake a lack of abuse from their captors for an act of kindness. These symptoms occur under tremendous emotional and often physical duress. And I'd like you to listen carefully to this. The behavior is considered a common survival strategy for victims of interpersonal abuse and has been observed in battered spouses, abused children, prisoners of war, and concentration camp survivors. According to Dr. Joseph Carver, PhD, 4 situations or conditions serve as a foundation for the development of Stockholm syndrome. They are the presence of a perceived threat to one's physical or psychological survival, and the belief that the abuser would carry out the threat. The presence of a perceived small kindness from the abuser to the victim. Isolation from perspectives other than those of the abuser. And the perceived inability to escape the situation. And I'll read those again because they're pretty impressive, I think. So, the 4 conditions that serve as a foundation for the development of Stockholm syndrome are the presence of a perceived threat to one's physical or psychological survival and the belief that the abuser would carry out the threat, the presence of a perceived small kindness from the abuser to the victim, isolation from perspectives other than those of the abuser, and the perceived inability to escape the situation. A good 90% of the women I have spoken to have told me that they could not live without their abusive partner. Just today I received an email in reply to a piece I wrote about women sacrificing their whole life to an abusive partner. The email said, "Recognizing the abusive partner is the easy part. Facing a life of poverty frightens me half to death. Maybe you need to write a follow-up book on that. Maybe I need to write a follow-up book about that." The woman in question has not even realized that her fear is her problem to deal with because she is totally overwhelmed by the fear that she cannot survive without her abuser. That is how Stockholm syndrome works. In the abusive kingdom, you become a hostage. Your captor allows you a degree of apparent freedom, but he uses a series of punishments to make sure that you never feel psychologically free or safe. He may also threaten your physical safety. That's an optional feature of the abusive kingdom, but not a necessary one. There will be the random, very small act of kindness, as well as the times when he behaves a little better to you. On those occasions, you'll experience the lack of abuse as acts of kindness or love, which they're not. You tend to respond with an adulation that is totally incomprehensible to onlookers. Why wouldn't it be? In the normal way, we respond to ill treatment by pulling away from the perpetrator. But what happens when we're not free to pull away from our jailers? According to the literature, it doesn't take long to develop Stockholm syndrome. If you're psychologically isolated, your life is threatened, or you feel your life is threatened, and at the same time, your jailer shows you occasional small kindnesses, then you're likely to be susceptible. I'd like to close this section of the teleclass with a statement about Stockholm Syndrome from Kathleen Gigiani. Stockholm Syndrome is a survival mechanism. The men and women who get it are not lunatics. They are fighting for their lives. They deserve our compassion, not ridicule. Stockholm Syndrome is a survival mechanism. The men and women who get it are not lunatics. They're fighting for their lives. They deserve compassion, not ridicule. We're all deserving of our own compassion, first of all, for what we've been through. We all need to develop that survival mechanism at some point. We were never lunatics. We no longer need to fight for our own lives. It's safe for you now to get that idea into your mental muscle. And on that note, I'd like to open the teleclass up for your comments and questions. So if you have muted yourself, do please unmute now by pressing star 7. And let's hear your comments.
I'm processing what you've said, Annie. It's almost... You just put into words the very things that I try to look and have tried to look for as patterns, and it's like you say, I'm so close to it, it's hard to see, and I kept thinking, why is it hard for me to see it? I can observe behaviors. I do that for a living in school. Why, oh why? And it's because I kept saying because I didn't want to see it, but I never really grasped what seems so simple now is that I kept looking for the pattern of him meeting the ideas that I had. So I kept seeing the misses, but I couldn't flip it around and see the misses and realize, you know, the mistakes or the missing of doing what I thought he had agreed to do. And inverting that and thinking, let me look at what he's doing and what I'm missing the other way. It just makes so much sense. And that's why there's no resolution ever. Yeah. And this is making it much easier, not that it's easy yet, to hold on to what I see in order to work with it, is that in the divorce process, all the maneuvering to keep it going on and on as long as possible, and wondering why is he doing that? Well, the why isn't important at all. That's a given now. But what is it and how to respond to it? And I have to write a paper to a response to an appeal, and this certainly helps answer the real thing and not the bizarre talk that is coming out.
Yeah. We get caught up in listening to the rubbish and refuting it piece by piece. You know, if he throws all this stuff at you, and you can lose yourself totally in the detail.
Yeah.
And one thing... Presumably one of his strategies in the divorce is that he really wants to tire you right out so that essentially you'll settle for anything and he'll get off cheaply.
Yes. How long can I endure being tied around my neck and tied to the back of the truck that takes off, stops suddenly, takes off.
Well, if you have a legal advisor, and I presume you have.
Yeah, I do.
Then you actually just say to this person, look, this is his strategy. This is the kind of thing he's doing. He's, you know, we want to ignore all the dross and just focus on the fact that the divorce has to go through and I have to make sure that I get the best settlement I can.
Yeah.
And that's really hard-headed on my part, but I know too many women who've come out with very much less than they should have done.
Oh, and I went in saying, I need to, my first visit was, I was just falling apart, saying all the reasons why I need to get out, I can't stand it, blah, blah, blah. And then I said, and now I'm going to say something to you that I told you in the beginning, don't listen to everything I say. I even countered it right from the beginning, but I had to say it, and in the end I said, and now here it comes. Make sure he gets everything he needs to live a comfortable life. I can make it on as little as possible. Honestly, and the lawyer just looked at me like, this is not what we're doing. And he took the case, and it's like part of me can still, I mean, was able to say what I knew I shouldn't be saying, but I still had to say it, and I said it for a very, very long time, even little bits and pieces of, well, he didn't really mean it, or, oh, why is he doing it, or let me just get upset and cry about it, and somehow it'll go away. And the tide turned, and now I get it, and now I have to just, I have to be able to be very calm so I can see what I normally can see, but it's hard to see that in a grown-up. It's just hard to do that.
Why do you have to say he's a grown-up?
Pardon?
Why do you have to say he's a grown-up? He's chronologically an adult man.
Yes.
Emotionally, he's not behaving like one. He's still a child.
Yeah. And that's how...
And he will, you know, he will twist and turn like an eel to try and get what he wants. Did I mention to you the email that my then husband sent me when I was divorcing?
No.
He told me that he was entitled to, and he would have half of everything we owned down to the tea towels.
Oh, my goodness.
They're actually really nice tea towels. I really like them. I haven't been able to... I'd had them a long time. They're cotton. They dried really well. I was in the outside catering trade at the time, so I was quite fond of my tea towels. But what happened... Still got them. What happened was that I got so caught up in how could he be so horrible to me, and isn't this demeaning that the man I married and loved can be so awful about tea towels?
Yes.
That it, you know, I wasted time talking to my solicitor who had the clock running all the time. Oh, tea towels, you know. Yes. And they said, well, don't worry about the tea towels. But it was just a ploy to make me not pay attention to his pension, which was the thing that he's really concerned about.
Yes.
You know, the big issues.
Okay.
So, and you know, he was prepared to do whatever it took, however undignified, in order to come out with the best settlement he could, and also to exert power and control over me that last time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, you know, it's, you can take it personally, or you can just see that that's his game.
Yes.
And his game is his game. Your priority is to move beyond that.
Yes.
Yeah.
As cheaply and effectively as possible.
Yeah. There's a real skill, the response that I have to write to it. There's something that was modeled in another situation by another a woman from a company who helped keep me out of what potentially might have been a fraudulent act on his part with this moving company. And I went back to just, I was calm enough to think, okay, she knew exactly what to do. And there were two things happening simultaneously. One is having to attend to the matter at hand. Okay, you have to talk about the things that are understood as the issues, the right to an appeal, whatever is said. Okay, but then to tease out the intent, the actual action that is taking place. And that's the tricky part, because if it becomes too much attention on what is not on the surface to be dealt with, I can sound like I'm being, like I'm not focused on actually what the court case is, that I'm being an hysterical person, or I'm not clear in my thinking. You see, it has to stay close enough to what is talked about. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. But does he have to choose what you talk about all the time?
Pardon?
But does he have to set the agenda for what you talk about all the time?
Because he's very skilled at keeping what he says in just the right amount of proximity to the legal flow of things, the legal arena. And so if it's not seeing what he's doing, then it looks like he's just talking about the legal case. And I use the example of the moving company because she knew that she had to deal with the shipment, but underneath she was dealing with somebody who was very likely a potential candidate for committing fraud against the company.
Hmm.
And you can't outwardly say anything because that would be slander with no... If you know something ahead of time, it's like a stalker. If you report that you're being stalked, you're not able to have help until you're actually hurt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, in a way, it's similar to that. How do you bring to light what is happening without stepping over what he knows is that boundary where it makes me or the other person look like they are exaggerating or making a mistake or making an assumption that can't be proven and quite likely couldn't be proven if brought forward too soon in
well,
the wrong way?
Let's take another tack, and
okay.
That is he really as clever at this as you think he is? The woman from the moving company saw him coming.
Yeah, yeah.
So is he really as good as you're frightened that he is? Or are you telling yourself a story about just how dangerous he is, which is not helpful to you?
I think I am... I'm calmer because I see what it is. I'm not feeling bamboozled. But I'm not confident, maybe because I couldn't see it, so I project that others can't see it, like the courts, that
yes,
they
that
wouldn't
was then.
See. Yeah. But
that
maybe
was then.
Yeah, maybe they will see it. Maybe they do see it, but I don't know that. It's not like they're going to have a conversation with me like the moving company person did.
But
she didn't have the conversation with me to disclose how she was going to go about doing it. She just said, let me have him. He's mine.
Yeah.
And you go on with your life. And she sent me an email that just said that she would. She hadn't heard from him, and she would need to do what was needed to protect me and her company. So it let me know that things could get upsetting, but I would not be needing to worry that I was a part of it or be accused of being a part of it, because I had been set up to look like, before she had talked to me, that I was a part of this.
Yeah.
So, too scared? I'm not too scared, but that's because I'm saying to myself, don't be scared, but maybe I am underneath.
So there's a lot of fear there. Your voice actually sounds stronger than it did. However, you are not the same. You're not as naive as you were then.
Yeah.
Are you? So
no,
that's the difference. And your legal representative, you know, needs to be looking out for you.
Yeah.
And needs to be, if necessary, discreetly asking, you know, what's the relevance of this, and where is your husband going with that?
Uh-huh.
You know, way of approaching things. You don't have to just blindly follow his agenda. You can disrupt it.
Yes.
And he will make the natural assumption. I mean, it's natural for him that you are a powerless, blind fool. That's my guess. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, it is. Yes.
So he will probably treat you with a degree of overt contempt. Which won't do him any good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're, in any case, you want to get yourself out of this fearful situation of, I've got to be so careful, he's so clever, you know, he could really make me look this way, that way, and the other way. He doesn't have to if you are taking charge of yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, acting like an adult woman with the support that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help?
Yeah, you just said it. Act like an adult woman. And everything you said tonight was about the manner in which we, or in which I would conduct my life as in certain situations, appearing as an adult woman, a professional, and once into the relationship, coming home, it would just digress into this, wow, I better be good.
Yeah. Yes, or my stroppy daddy will, or stroppy whoever he is, will really take it out on me.
Yeah. And never calling him on it. Never.
Oh, no. Don't do that.
Yeah.
That's much too dangerous.
Yeah. The session has been really very helpful.
Good. Laurie, what about you?
When you said abuse, any kind of abuse that he's inflicting makes him feel as powerful as he's ever going to feel, that really struck a chord with me. Because ultimately, I think he feels very powerless. I don't think he feels very powerful at work.
Sure.
I don't think he feels very powerful in any aspect of his existence, honestly. So he's gaining his power. That's why I think he baits fights, arguments, disagreement, just absolute contempt. So often, well, quite literally, every weekend. He can't do it during the week because, quite frankly, I don't see him. I stay away because he's home only a few hours and then back up to drive this horrible commute. It's not fun. It's extremely stressful for him, as it is for me, and I'm not driving it, but it is for me because I'm here manning the entire ship all the time. I think that's really true. I think he's gaining his sense of power. And I think my dad did exactly the same thing with my mother. He gained his sense of power by abusing my mom. Because I know he felt totally powerless in every other aspect of his life.
Mm-hmm.
That really struck a chord with me. And also, considering my current situation, doubting yourself increases his power over you. Which, I'm sure it does. It doesn't stop me from doubting myself, but that thought can certainly enter into it when I do doubt myself.
And he did a classic thing. He, because he felt fairly weak and inadequate, he managed to hitch up to a woman who presented as a strong woman.
Yeah? I think that's true. Yeah, I do think that's true.
Yeah, and
because I did.
Really, Yeah, that's a very common thing. However, on the one hand, this is what he's attracted to, and on the other hand, he has to undermine that. So he's been very helpfully, you know, seeing that you get stuck in your career and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because he, you know, he has to try to get rid of his own sense of powerlessness.
Exactly. I think that's completely correct.
Yeah. And my ex-husband was a man who could exercise formidable personal power. He was a GP, he was a physician, and occasionally, like other doctors, he'd be called in front of committees of physicians and other people when he had, you know, when patients were unhappy with his work, mm-hmm. and sometimes mm-hmm. he was in the wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And he would go into these committees, and frankly, he would scare the other people witless. You know, he had this jury of his peers around him, and he always got off because they virtually needed a nappy when they're in a room with him, and he was in full flow. And for all that, he had this core of, you know, powerlessness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a very powerful man in some ways, and yet he had this core of self-pity and powerlessness. And it's a very curious combination.
Mine also actually teaches other people in his company sales techniques, sales skills. Therefore, he's very accomplished at selling things,
yeah.
ideas, himself. Extremely accomplished at it. And he can put on a very good show. I said once, I felt like he was just this little cutout figure, cardboard cutout figure, propped up against the wall, because I really don't even know who he is. If I think about it, he's just this cardboard cutout figure that is one thing one minute and something else the next, depending upon how he wants to play the situation.
And he doesn't really know who he is.
I don't think he does either, no.
No.
But for the longest time, he adopted my persona. For the longest time, he agreed with everything I said, did everything I wanted, wouldn't even make a decision on which box of cereal to buy unless I said, that's a good idea. And it was terrifically annoying to me. And I expressed, you know, just pick whatever you want. Make your own decisions. You don't always have to agree with me. Don't you have your own ideas? Don't you have your own opinions? Don't always agree with me. Because for the longest time in our relationship early on, and I mean years, we never disagreed about anything because he was constantly kowtowing to everything I said.
Hmm.
Now it's overtly vicious.
Yes.
From him.
Yes. But that was far from healthy as well.
Oh, well, yes, absolutely. Yeah, it was.
Yes.
But he never wanted to consider it as something that he needed to work on. Because to him, he doesn't need to work on anything, ever.
No. Well, no, I mean, he was a good husband because he let Mommy Bear make all the decisions.
Mm-hmm. And he needed Mommy Bear to make all the decisions because he would not even decide where to go on vacation. In fact, I had to convince him to go to a certain place that he had never been before. I had never been either, but I said, I've heard great things about it. Let's just try it. And he was completely opposed to it. Once we went, we both loved it. He wanted to go nowhere else for 20 years. And I'm not kidding. 20 years.
He doesn't
he would
like
go
the
nowhere
habit,
else.
Doesn't he?
He loves a rut.
Yes.
He loves
does, indeed.
A, yeah.
Yes. So you have to say, in a charitable sort of way, he's a man of very limited personal resources.
Mm, yeah.
So no wonder he attached himself to you like a leech, really.
He really did, yeah.
Yeah. And then he found that there's another way with your daughter. Anyway, moving on from there, we're going to see what was some of what were your childhood issues. That was one of the things that we're going to look at tonight. One of the unfortunate things that you learnt in childhood. And I do love the first argument technique. The first conflict that you had of whatever kind that was with your partner, certain, it would have been about something, and certain feelings or behaviors would have come up, which would have been a splendid clue to what you learnt as a kid. My first argument with my husband, before he was my husband, was when he was sitting in a car on a hot day and he couldn't be bothered to get out. And I said, well, aren't we going to go out and have a drink? And he went ballistic at me. He was shouting and screaming, who do you think you are? What do you want from me? I'm going to sit here and sleep. So on his side, it was demands, demands. Everybody's making demands on me. On my side, I sat there because I'd been taught that people had a right to shout at me. I believe that people had a right to shout at me. It was always my fault. And the best thing I could do was shut up and take whatever happened. And now these are really useful beliefs that I've been taught. You know, as a woman, one sits out and takes stuff. These really useful beliefs that I've been taught, preparing me, grooming me, unintentionally, for an abusive relationship. Now, I'm wondering if you think of your own first conflicts, even if overt or covert, with your partner, what were they about? And what beliefs did they trigger in you? What beliefs did you reveal?
I think I've already mentioned mine.
Yeah.
Honestly, because ours went on for so, our relationship early on went on for so many years with almost an unnerving lack of conflict. Simply because he was continually agreeing with me. He was a yes man. He never had his own ideas, his own opinions. So when I brought that up, then that became a point of conflict. So probably, when I think back on it, that's probably one of the first things we had conflict about, not having conflict.
But there was more, because you had a job that you wanted, and he very carefully made sure you didn't take it.
Absolutely. Well, I took it. I took it. But ultimately, I backed down, and I left the job to go back to him, and we weren't married at that point. Now, I was extremely afraid of failure. Yes. I had very low self-esteem, and I felt that he was my best friend, and I really missed him, and he wasn't coming through with his promise that he was going to join me no matter what, and I could see it never happening. So I acquiesced and went back to him and my old job. Totally ruined my career. I'm sorry?
Yeah, and let's just look at that, because it's a really important one at this precise moment in time. And there was something there about you always had to sacrifice what you wanted to get some kind of emotional support.
Truly, yeah.
Yeah.
Truly.
And that
even
would
as a child.
Go back a long time.
Yeah,
a long, long time. Yeah. And that's a really important one for you, especially at the moment.
Hmm.
You know,
it is.
Really,
yeah.
You know, you, in the end, your feelings, your aspirations, what are your talents, whatever, don't matter. You have to give up on yourself in order to get a bit of love and support.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to pay for that big time. Would that be fair?
Absolutely. Not only love and support, but I think I do it mostly because of fear and insecurity, because I had total fear and insecurity as a child. And that's sort of the first horse out of the gate in situations such as this, the fear and insecurity kick in, and then I just, at least I used to, crumble.
Yeah.
And I'm having a hard time dealing with that.
Yes. I have this lovely, lovely friend who's talking about a time when he's talking about someone he'd been talking to, and he was saying that in this conversation he was talking about something he did, something, his specialism. And the woman he's talking to said, oh, I already do that. You know, I've been doing this for such and such a time, I've been doing this in such and way. And he looked at her and he simply said to her, that is not this, and then is not now. And that phrase has stayed with me. It was one of the most empowering things I've ever heard.
That's
that
wonderful.
Is not this,
yes.
And then is not now.
Yeah.
And perhaps you need to start saying that to yourself.
You're correct.
True.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. He's right. Thanks, John.
He's right. Yeah. He is right.
He always is right. Bless him. He's a wonderful man. Wilhelmina, if you think back to your first conflict with your husband, can you remember the fight or the whatever it was, the conflict, whatever happened?
Yeah, curiously, this idea of not fighting was a badge of honor that I wore for many years.
Ooh.
We didn't fight. Mm-hmm. How great that was, because I grew up middle child. I saw how people felt, and I spoke about it. And it was in a family where you weren't supposed to do that. You were not supposed to see anything and certainly not say anything. And it's only been recent that I have come to realize that perhaps a talent or a gift or whatever it is that I have in seeing those in the world around me, not in any judgmental fashion, just seeing what there is in a curious manner of what was being said or what was said behind the words or what you must be feeling. This is how your energy feels when I came up to you. That was really forbidden, and I didn't realize that what I was doing was the fearful thing. I internalized myself as being bad, and so to be bad meant that nobody would like me.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to be liked, I wanted to be loved, and so I stopped doing any of that, and I became silly. And the silliness.
What do you mean silly?
Silly, I would say funny things, or I would stop looking at what really was and just be silly, allow myself to have the attention of, oh, there she is again, or, oh, just, I don't know, I wouldn't even have to. Maybe I am funny, naturally. And so that was something that later on I became very, very serious, because when I was called silly, I felt I had a bad feeling. I had a sad feeling, like I had used that and I had lost something. And I really didn't know what I had, you know, lost. And I did all that so there wouldn't be turmoil. It seemed whatever I would do would create turmoil, although I was never a bad person, and I never had a need to make somebody else feel bad or something happen to get attention that was, you know, bad or frightening. It just was being natural, and I didn't realize how much people are really afraid of themselves if it's just shown that somebody sees you, or if somebody sees me.
Yeah.
So
I did a lot of, I think one of the things, I did a lot of hiding, and I didn't realize that. That's an issue for me right now, to get out of hiding, something you said last time about the way I speak even. And then, so in the marriage, I married late, and everybody was relieved that I had finally gotten married, and it was conveyed, don't mess it up, don't say too much.
Right.
So not arguing was big. And so the first argument was really the day after we got married, and I didn't say anything. And that was already, the behavior was there of the dismissal, the isolation. And I couldn't comprehend it. Now I realize what the subtleties were about it. But I think the first time I spoke up and disagreed was when I really didn't want to sit down together and write Christmas cards. That was not what I did. And I certainly didn't want to sit with anybody if I wrote a card. I'd want it to be personal. And it just became a very uncomfortable situation. And funny, because it's Christmas cards and joy and love and happiness. And I felt like I was really being called on the carpet for disagreeing, and I better sit down and write them. And I sat down and wrote stupid things, but I just did it. I'd never done it like that before. I never felt like that. And then I got used to it.
Yeah,
I just let myself get used to it. And so we didn't fight, and not until, it was only weeks before he was finally leaving the house, and the divorce, or the separation papers had already been served,
and he exploded,
and it was the night from hell, December 3rd, and I just let it out. I let it happen, the raging, and I just sat there, and I thought, he can burn everything about me, but he can't have my bones. That's my soul. He can't have that, so I'm not afraid. But after it was over, I never had felt that in my whole life. And it was like he had wanted to do that a long time. And he had done it in different ways and kept me down, you know. But at that point, he let it go. And I thought, wow, this is what I was so afraid of all these years. I would never have wanted to see this. I'd never been spoken to like that.
No.
So the fight came really late that I answered
that. The actual fight that you engaged in came late, but the first kind of fight in terms of, you know, the argument over the Christmas cards,
yeah,
or the non-argument over the Christmas cards came in and brought in all those beliefs. And I was quite interested in the fact that you were perceived in your family to have caused turmoil by being aware of people's feelings.
Yeah.
So presumably there was a big thing in your family that feelings were much too dangerous to... There were some very, very bad feelings that were knocking around in them, which somehow this little sensitive, compassionate person stirred up unintentionally. Because it was just, you had childhood, the innocence of childhood, and you just thought that it was safe to express the best that was in you in an honest manner.
Yeah, and not knowing that people weren't doing that. I just thought everybody did that.
Yes, not knowing that for your family, that was really something that they found very dangerous.
And
unthreatening, and had to repress quite brutally.
Yeah.
So then the next strategy was, well, I wouldn't mind a little bit of attention and a little bit of love, so maybe I can get it by being a clown and making them laugh if they're so unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't like that one much either. So they then told you you were silly.
Yeah.
So you tried two strategies that, given that you were young and your resources were not that sophisticated, but two strategies that were really pretty good, really. You know?
Yeah, those are good things to do. Those are things that I do, and I tend to be funny in a funny way.
Oh, sure, you are.
And I care about what I see and how people are, but I'm not so naive about how other people might receive it, so I'm not doing what I did in childhood. But I didn't do any of it. I just completely ignored those things until pretty recently, and then I thought, wow,
yeah,
this is pretty neat. I do see, and I am funny, but...
Yes,
yeah.
And some people have no sense of humor. It's just a fact.
Yeah.
I've got the most beautiful little dog in the world. And we go on walks sometimes. When we go on walks, he knows that everybody's going to fall at his paws because he's just so pretty. And every so often, we come across someone who walks straight past him. And because I'm very protective of my little dog's ego, when we're in decent distance away, I say to him, Basil, some people have no taste, but it's their problem. You know, you can't make it, you can't make everybody laugh, but some people have no sense of humor. But going back to your specific situation, with your husband, you realized it was exactly the same as childhood, that you couldn't get your point across, you couldn't be heard. And therefore, the best thing was to just to shut up and not upset people.
Yeah. It was frustrating not to know what to do. And it's only now, in these last weeks, realizing, rather than be preoccupied with what has happened and da-da-da, it's, okay, what skills do I need to learn? Like moving forward. And I thought, gosh, even if it's, you know, I'm 53, I'm growing up, so it's like, well, that's okay. Better now than 60 or 70. And it's learning really how to just conduct life in a respectable way for myself. And
let's just conclude this call with a different perspective. It's not really the skills that you've got to learn that are so important. You've got those skills. You had those skills when you were a little girl, when you were funny and you had empathy and you cared about other people and you put your voice out there and naturally assumed that you would be liked. Those are all skills. You know, you knew how to engage, you were interesting, you were involved, you were sensitive to people. You had a load of skills and they just didn't wash. You had skills, resources, quality. They just didn't go down too well with your family because your family had their own wounds.
Mm-hmm.
And what you need to do now is not learn the skills. You've got the skills.
Mm-hmm.
What you need and what you're doing is unlearning the fear.
Ah.
Unlearning being responsible for other people's responses. You know. Does that make sense?
That's so poignant. Yeah.
You know,
very poignant.
My dog walks through the street. He's drop dead gorgeous. If people don't like him, it's their issue. He doesn't go and say, my God, should I be a brown and white shih tzu instead of a black and white shih tzu? Should I not jump up at them? He just thinks, whatever. And that's really what we've got to learn. You know, you're safe. You can keep yourself safe now. And it's just about letting go of that fear and understanding that those who don't like it, that's their stuff.
Yeah.
But the more confident you feel, the less people are going to say, you can't behave like that.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And the more they'll just sit and say, God, I wish I had a piece of that.
Oh, that'll be the day. I'll be wagging my tail like your little Shih Tzu.
I believe that my dogs are my life teachers. And they don't always teach me the things I want, which is another thing, because possibly we're focusing on the wrong stuff. But Basil is a great teacher. We've had dreadful, dreadful problems with his house training. He's now 8.5 months, and he's finally cracked it. But the reason that he finally cracked it in part is that I learned his most important language. I rewarded him for going out and doing what he should do outside by giving him a treat to eat. And it suddenly struck me that for Basil, play is much more important than treats, than treats that you eat.
Mm-hmm.
And the learning in there is all about, you know, what are our love languages? What really floats our boat and makes us feel good? And what does that with other people as well? It's a whole separate conversation, but, you know, if someone says to you, you look really good, and what you honestly want is a hug, the words aren't going to really touch you, are they?
Right.
Mm-mm. So, it's a whole different topic. It's about how do you know what your real needs are, so you can get them met.
Yeah.
And until I met Basil's need for playing ball, he wasn't going to meet my need for getting the toilet training done. But it really, it's a serious conversation for another time, because we really have reached the end of this tonight.
Okay.
But
thank you very much.
Pleasure. What's been the most useful thing for you tonight?
It's the being able to hear words that succinctly describe what was happening. Last week, who the woman is. Who the week before, who the abuser is. And it's amazing. Yeah, to just now hear it. Before, it was all invisible and just happening at rocket speed around, and no time to stop, nobody talking about it, no one trying to look at it, and here it is.
And heaven forbid you try to talk about it, because it will be totally dismissed, minimalized, and blamed upon you.
Of course, of course. Laurie, what's been the most important thing for you?
Probably the things that I made note of, the abuse that makes the abuse act itself is making him feel powerful as he's ever going to feel.
Yes.
And unfortunately, it was always there. It was always there under the surface, and he didn't feel safe in letting it out until there was a third party available to support him emotionally. And then when our daughter became that third party, that's when it became safe in his mind to act out all his resentment that he was really feeling.
And you've done this rotten trick of supplanting him as your child.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
How thoughtless. Great. Yeah. So I think I'm going to stop the recording now, and I know that you and I, Laurie, are going to have another couple of minutes.
Right.
And I say, see you next week, Wilhelmina.
Very good.
And have fun. And I'll just stop the recording.
Okay.
So good night,
Laurie.
Good night, Wilhelmina.
Okay, bye. I enjoyed hearing from you, Laurie.
It's lovely.